Revolution. It has tremendous lessons for all of us. It's almost a blueprint for what is currently happening, what we can expect down the road, and also our reaction to it. I started on this quest because I have always adored Nathan Hale since I was a child and first learned about him. I thought he was the greatest thing ever to hit the earth. But I didn't know much about him. I just know what most children hear. He died, and here's what he said, and he defied the government. He stood up to them, and in front of the British Army, when all these enemies were grouped around him, watching him die, he said, "I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country." And I was just blown away. I thought that was the most heroic thing. And as a child, I read whatever I could find about him, but that wasn't much. There are a couple of children's books written on him. Generally, you'll find more mention of him in histories of the American Revolution. When I became an adult, I began researching that because I tried to find a novel about Nathan Hale. I thought, this is a really dramatic story, and surely some historical novelist somewhere has written about this. Because I'm a big history fiction buff. I love history in general, and if you can write a novel that's set during a historical period, boy, I'm there. I am your most avid reader. To my astonishment, despite Nathan Hale's incredible heroism and the intense drama, you know, you just picture that guy in Tiananmen Square holding up his hand in front of the tank, and the tank, one man against the power of an established government. That's Nathan Hale. Just the most incredibly dramatic story you can imagine. One that's played out several times in history, always with very dire results for the hero, but still something that really compels your attention. To my astonishment, nobody had ever written a novel about him. Again, we have lots of kids' books, but we don't have anything for adults. So I decided to be that person. I wrote a novel about him that necessitated researching not only his life, but the larger context of the American Revolution. I had always been in agreement with Thomas Jefferson's "that government is best which governs least." I grew up hating government ever since I was 4 years old, and I told my mother, "I want to get a job," and she told me, "They won't let you. They want to protect children. You can't work without their permission." I was outraged. I can still remember being 4 years old and throwing a temper tantrum over that. How dare they invade my life. How dare they say they're protecting me when I want to earn a salary? So ever since then, I have hated government, but my knowledge and study of the American Revolution turned me into a full-fledged anarchist. There is no such thing as good government. We need to get rid of it in its entirety. So I wrote a novel on Nathan Hale. It's currently available at Amazon. If you search for my last name, A-K-E-R-S, and the title of the novel, Hailstorm, it's all one word, H-A-L-E-S-T-O-R-M. I didn't realize there apparently is some sort of rock group or punk rock group. I don't follow popular music, so I don't really know what I'm talking about, but there's some punk group called Hailstorm. So if you just enter Hailstorm, my novel is not going to pop up. You're going to get everything on the rock group. So do enter my last name, too. Available on Amazon in either paperback or for Kindle. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. Again, enter Hailstorm. You can get it at Smashwords. So it will be a good introduction to the anarchic philosophy of the American Revolution, even though it's not what I was trying to write. If you are an honest novelist or honest writer in general about the American Revolution, the anarchy has got to come out.
That is a really powerful statement. I remember the first time I read Rothbard's version of that time frame in Conceived in Liberty, I was just blown away. I had never seen history laid out like that before.
Yes. I'm not surprised by that statement, Ben. Conventional history posits the American Revolution as a battle by Americans against the British government. And that's not what it was at all. It was a battle of taxpayers against the British government. It was against government. The fact that it was British was simply coincidental. It was a battle by people who were tired of corporatism. We may think that's a phenomenon of our day where corporations are in bed with the government and they're wreaking untold havoc on us, on our liberty. TSA is a perfect example of that. TSA could not exist except for the corporations lined up to offer it product and services. Okay, so, and that's why the TSA is still in business despite the incredible public outrage against it. It's depredation, it's gate rape, it's persecution of the elderly and the vulnerable and the sick, just like the Nazi regime. Okay, and I don't say that lightly. I've been studying the Nazis lately and I am appalled. You know, it's one thing to say just in general that our government is following in the Nazi path. It is appalling to start reading the history and find out specific examples of how our government is doing that. But at any rate, the American colonists and British people were as tired of corporatism as we are. They had the British East India Company that the British government directly funded, directly used to exploit the people of India. They had a bunch of other mercantilist laws. We would call them tariffs, import-export laws, that restricted the ability of British consumers and American consumers to buy the products they wanted in favor of patronizing the king's cronies. Okay, all of these things, the high taxes, okay, many people don't realize, unless they've studied the period, the British nobility didn't pay taxes. All of the king's wealth, and the guy was making 800,000 pounds a year. All of that came from British taxpayers, the serfs, the ordinary people, the people like us. Okay, but the very wealthy who'd been given their lands at everybody else's expense didn't pay any. So all of this injustice figured in. It was people fed up with government wanting to live free, and by that expression we mean wanting to live free of government, of politicians, of war, of taxation. All those people fighting against government. They happened to be British.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize, you mentioned the British East India Company there, the Boston Tea Party was a direct strike against that corporation. That was
absolutely right.
Free and independent people saying, we're not going to tolerate this corporation doing this to us.
That's exactly right. And what really grieves me a lot is that the modern Tea Partiers don't seem to have any idea that it is government that was putting the corporations into power. And modern Tea Party just keeps insisting, if we get the right people in government, And the occupiers of Wall Street, too, whether it's left or right, we have this same fallacy that the problem is not government, the problem is who's in government. And, of course, we anarchists understand, no, it's government. The colonists understood that. The Tea Partiers in Boston understood that. They were protesting government and its coziness and cronyism. It's collaborating with private enterprise, with private merchants to defraud the rest of us, to enslave the rest of us. That's what the American Revolution was all about.
Absolutely. And we should clarify, in case somebody's confused by our terminology, we're not anti-business, we're not anti property, we're not anti-company, but what our problem is when a corporation and the government work hand in hand to fill each other's pocket at our expense. That's really what we're talking about, because it all comes back to the violence that the state introduces into the mix.
Ben, let me enlarge that a bit, because you're absolutely right. The market, the free market, and again by free we mean free of government market, I'm convinced is one of God's greatest blessings to us.
Absolutely.
Because of the market, people feed themselves, they're able to clothe themselves. We don't live short, nasty, brutish lives anymore, and that's largely because of God's blessing of the free market that unleashes human creativity in pursuit of its own self-interest. And, you know, again, Adam Smith with the invisible hand and the we don't look to the butcher and baker for our dinner out of their compassion, but because they are interested in providing for themselves. That's why they're incidentally contributing to our welfare. This is a marvelous, wonderful, incredible blessing. The market's great, but when we ally government with it, or anything else, you know, I'm always chagrined at my fellow Christians that call for the government to legislate morality, as if you can. As if you can't, as if you can force someone to practice virtue. It can't be done, because virtue implies voluntary action. If I hold a gun on you and I say, don't commit adultery, Ben, you don't get any brownie points when you don't. You're simply in fear of your life. Similarly, I don't get any brownie points because I don't take heroin. I don't take it because I don't want to go to jail. Okay, so we can't legislate morality, and yet so many Christians don't understand this. They want the government allied with their church. They want established religion. I want the pledge in public schools, which is a laugh in itself. I'm sure we all know how the pledge is a socialist invention by committed socialists, and yet we have Christians today asking for school kids to pledge their allegiance to the state simply because Eisenhower stuck the words in under God. But, I mean, what kind of insanity is this? If you're a Christian, God has called you to discernment and wisdom, to be out there fighting the state's battle for it and trying to recruit more school kids to pledge their allegiance. This is satanic, folks. But at any rate, we have so many Christians that have wanted the state to be allied with their church. And again, anytime the state touches anything, whether it's business, whether it's a church, whether it's a private personal relationship, as in the quest now for homosexual marriage, okay? Anytime the state touches anything, it utterly corrupts it. The state is basically a huge King Kong, and it's going to crush the little girl in its hand, no matter who that girl is, business, church, personal relationships.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when you're talking there about that union between church and state, that so many Christians just embrace this idea, and yet if you think about how Jesus reacted to this temptation when he was taken up on the mountain and shown all the state's existence all throughout time and all the empires and everything, and the devil says, this is my realm, I can give it to you if you want it, and
yes,
he refused it. He didn't want anything.
That's right.
And if you think of people like the Apostle Paul or Peter or those guys who were more than willing to lay down their life rather than pledge their allegiance to their state.
You know, Ben, one of the saddest things I've read in a long time was a plea from Voice of the Martyrs. This was, 3 or 4 years ago, I saw this, trying to justify to the American church why it defies the law in other countries to distribute Bibles. And I thought, if you actually have to explain that it's better to obey God rather than men, if you have to explain that to the Christian church in America today, there is no hope. Okay, this is apostasy. Lord. This is absolute, utter, heretical apostasy. And Christian, if you are guilty of that, you need to repent, you need to get into the Word, and you need to see how God rebukes the satanic state, how Christ turned his back on a satanic state. Let's also remember who nailed him to that cross, the satanic state. Yes, our sins put him there, but the satanic state was in charge of crucifying the Son of God. That in itself should be enough to turn any Christian irrevocably against the state. That in itself should be enough to turn all of us into anarchists. And that it doesn't says something about the church's, quote, devotion to its Lord and Savior.
I think also of that scripture in the Old Testament where, the judge Samuel was approached by the leadership of the tribes of Israel, and they were all, you know, I think secretly in their minds, they were all hoping each one of them would be king or some member of their family would be chosen king or whatever. But they came to Samuel and they begged him to anoint a king, and he was really personally offended at this. And God said, no, 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 they're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting God. When they demand a king, they reject God. I don't see how that could be clearer.
Then there is a wonderful anecdote from the American Revolution. I read it once. I wish I'd have made note of it because I've never been able to find it again. So you have to trust me on this one. I can't tell you the author who first recorded it or what year or anything. But two Bostonians went to see the Howes when they were in the Howe brothers. Richard Howe was an admiral, led the British Navy in the American Revolution against us. His brother, William Howe, later became Lord Howe, was the commander of the British Army. Okay, so these two guys are in Boston, and a couple of the Bostonians come to see them, and they request an interview with Mr. Howe. And the aide of whichever Howe it was they were trying to see, I think it probably would have been Lord Richard, Admiral Howe at that point, because William Howe earned his title later. But at any rate, the aide says, sniffs very distinctly and says, "We have nobody named Mr. Howe here. We do have Lord Howe." And the colonists say to him, "We have no Lord but Jesus Christ." I think, where are the American Christians today that will stand up to Leviathan and say, "I have no Lord but Jesus Christ. You are satanic. Get out of my life." Where are they?
Now, somebody might ask, you mentioned, what source material. Somebody might ask, because I get asked this all the time, where did you get this? How did you start thinking like this? And I start thinking, well, I don't know. You know, I can always mention Rothbard as a source, but there's other places too. Like I dig around on the Library of Congress's website and read the letters of George Washington, and you really get to see what kind of a slimy guy he was when you start doing this, you know. But it's hard to just nail it down and say, this is my source of why I have this opinion. Do you have any particular resources or sources that you like to fall back on?
Well, I started off with a father who was a Christian minister and a mother, a devout Christian, and they both told me Bible stories by the hour before I could even read, before I could even talk. I was in church when I was 9 days old. I think that all of the who are wondering why the state bans the Bible from schools should understand the reason it does, and that is because of things like the story about Daniel in the lion's den. Yeah, big, nasty government throwing dissidents into lion's dens. Or Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. Okay, again, we've got a big, nasty ruler throwing people who disagree with him, who disagree out of righteousness, by the way, who are doing the right thing, thrown into fiery furnaces. Then there's the Massacre of the Innocents, where we have a Roman ruler coming and just indiscriminately killing all Jewish children, okay, 2 years old and under. I mean, what kind of wickedness is this? You don't have to be very old. I certainly wasn't, to see the utter depravity of government. So I grew up already knowing that. When it came time to research the American Revolution, I relied heavily, and you mentioned some of them, Ben, on primary sources. I don't want the revolution filtered through other people. Now, you might want to start off with a history of the American Revolution as a narrative history instead of primary sources, because it is difficult to take a letter from George Washington and just read it, and you have no context in which to put it. If you're going to start off with a narrative history, a secondary source on the American Revolution, I strongly recommend Page Smith. He wrote a two-volume history in 1976 called A New Age Now Begins. And again, his name's very easy to remember since it's Page, like in a book, Smith. He is pretty good. He was an officer in the U.S. Army, so he's not by any means an anarchist, but he's pretty good about surveying all primary sources, and he's usually pretty accurate. That's the next thing. Be very careful when you read secondary sources, because you'd be amazed how much mythology creeps into them. My touchstone, again, is Nathan Hale. One quick example of the mythology, Nathan supposedly wrote two letters before the British hanged him, the British government hanged him. I make a point in my novel of calling them the government as much as I can without confusing readers, again, because it's not a war against the British, it's a war against government. But at any rate, before the government hanged Nathan Hale, he wrote two letters. Supposedly, one of those was to his mother. And you will find that quoted in many secondary sources. His mother had been dead for 9 years when Nathan was hanged. So that's one of the things I use. I'll always flip. If I'm going to buy a secondary resource, I don't do it very often, but if I'm going to invest in a secondary resource, I'll always see if Nathan's mentioned and who they have him writing to before he died. And if the mother is in there, that's it. I realize the guy's not too careful. Page Smith doesn't make those kind of errors. That's one reason I recommend him strongly. But my first recourse is always primary sources. Go to them, because as you say, Ben, you're getting the original person without filtering through somebody else's perceptions and prejudices. Let the person speak to you himself. I also have to say, I'm with you on Washington being fairly sleazy in the presidency, but there's been a big push among anarchists lately to really damn the founding fathers. I'm not going to go that far. I mean, yes, they were all fallible human beings. They made a lot of mistakes. They're also kind of on a continuum. We have really anarchic founders like Sam Adams. I mean, man was an out-and-out anarchist, all the way over to his cousin John, who is an out-and-out tyrant. And the guy loved the state, and all he wanted was an American state with him at its head. That's why he was fighting the American Revolution. Betrayed his family, abandoned them for years at a time in pursuit of this ambition. Okay, the guy is not admirable. I don't care for him at all. However, I will say this about all of them and about the modern folks who are condemning them so strongly. Most of us have never suffered anything worse than a paper cut in our fight for liberty.
Yeah.
Okay, these guys gave their lives, okay? Until you stand up against a battalion from the U.S. Army and you defy it, until you hold up your hand in Tiananmen Square against a U.S. tank, I don't want to hear criticism of the founders, because we're not in their league. Let's remember something else about them, too. Liberty is an evolving and changing philosophy. We are discovering new insights on it today. They didn't have these insights. Remember that Adam Smith is coming out in 1776. They don't know much about economic freedom. Okay, and all of the later insights of the Austrian school, they have none of that. None of that, okay? And they are still fighting as they best understand against the state, okay? So I very quickly lose patience with the paper-cut warriors who want to condemn men who suffered smallpox, who died, who lost their estates, who lost their families in many cases, whose sons would be imprisoned when they were captured by the British at the British government in a battle, whose sons were tortured on prison ships when they were taken prisoner by the government, okay? This guy in Congress never went home, stood there and inveighed against the government while it was torturing his sons on prison ships. When we have attained that level of courage and that level of action against government, then we're in a position to criticize the founders.
I need to pause here, and we'll save this file, and folks, we'll be right back with more with Becky Akers.
I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site, all the courses plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help keep badquaker.com on the internet. Thank you very much.
Thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And again, with me today is Becky Akers, a prolific writer, and as you can, if you've been listening to the podcast so far, as you can tell, she is a fighter for liberty. And Becky, let's just take right back off on what we were talking about there. You had mentioned Paige Smith, and I had mentioned Murray Rothbard, and you had mentioned going to primary sources, and you had also said that we should not judge the founders too harshly without fully understanding what kind of risks and the terrible things that they went through so that they could achieve what they achieved. I think you know, Americans are so insulated from what most of the human experience has been. We've been, you know, we've had such an easy life for the last 50, 75 years in America that we really don't even understand these things.
I read about what the founding generation, what the 3 million Americans who inhabited the British colonies in North America, what their daily lives were like, the dangers they confronted. And I have to agree with you, Ben. I look around, you know, I live in New York City. I walk down the street. I look at the soft people all around me. I think you wouldn't survive a day in colonial America. You can't stand walking along without a bottle of water in your hand. Do you know that water in colonial America, do you know how precious it was? Do you know what you had to go through to get a drink? And that's just a physical thing. The emotional and mental softness is astonishing. As I read of the American Revolutionary's reaction to government, now again, a lot of people say to tyranny. I don't make that qualification. It was government, because government is tyranny. There is no such thing as a good or benevolent government. It is force, it is compulsion, it is physical brutality, it is utter tyranny in any, however limited, quote, it may be. And let's also dispense with that myth. You can't limit government any more than you can limit cancer. When cancer is a good thing and just a little bit of it helps us, then talk to me about limited government. Until that time, understand that government, like cancer, grows. Jefferson told us that. It's nature. You can't expect anything else, but that the leeches who populate government will always seek to get more and more of your life under their control, because they want more and more of your money to fund their lavish lives. Okay? So government always grows. When I see how Americans now accept that, not even just accept it, that they don't have any problem with it. I saw a video clip on the net, made within the last year, at least posted within the last few days, of passengers in Columbus, Ohio, at the airport, waiting to take off. And the TSA has two of its sponges going around meddling, harassing people, forcing them to give their drinks. Take the lid off your drink, let me test it to make sure it's not an explosive. Yes, you're sitting there drinking it. Not too many people drink explosives, but doesn't matter. I want to get in there, and I want to meddle with you. Like, I want to teach you to obey. What was horrifying about this was, of course, the thugettes' actions and their absolute dictatorship over passengers. But what was equally horrifying was the fact that everyone just took this as standard procedure. I didn't see a single person protest. I didn't see a single person even lift his eyes from his newspaper or his book or take his eyes off the television screen in the corner of the video. Okay? People are just going about their business as though this is perfectly rational. rational behavior. This is what we should expect from a government. Now, it is, in that sense, absolutely. That is what we should expect from government. That's what it does best, is order people around and do absolutely senseless things. But the fact that everybody goes about their business while this is going on, the other thing that really disturbs me to the point that I no longer will even watch them are the videos parents used to make.
Yeah.
Of the TSA molesting their kids. Explain that one to me. Okay, you're going to put your hands down my child's pants, and I'm going to stand there while you do it, and I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to photograph it.
Amazing.
What is this, a Kodak moment? Where is the outrage? Where are Americans getting out in the streets demanding that heads roll and that this absolute pedophilism ends?
Absolutely.
And parents stand there and photograph it.
I often say this, you know, my grandfather passed away in the back in the 80s, and he was he spent his whole life in Appalachia, and many people would say that a person like that is backward and they're a hick or they're a hillbilly, or they would say any other kind of, you know, statement like that about a person who spent their whole life in the mountains of Appalachia. But I've often said that if my grandfather, if somebody would have approached him the way the TSA, just in the general attitude that they have,
yes,
and come up and put their hands on him, he would have pulled his .32 pistol out of his pocket and filled their guts full of lead. He would have done it without even blinking. Because
precisely the attitude of the American Revolutionary generation, not just the Founding Fathers, but Americans in general. I try to picture George Washington at an airport today while Martha is being groped. And I have a very good imagination, Ben. I can write novels. I can sit down and imagine stuff and conjure it up. Don't need any help in those lines. I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
I try to picture Nathaniel Greene, who led some of the American Army. He was very famous for his campaign in the South that concluded triumphantly at Yorktown. But I try to imagine Nathaniel Greene standing there while his wife, Kitty, is insulted and abused by lackeys from the government.
Yeah.
And again, my imagination is just, I just don't see. I see Nathaniel Greene taking a horsewhip to these people and teaching them, this is not the way you talk to my wife. Now, I'm going to give American men a pass because they have been feminized by 100 years of socialism, communism, and feminism, which is another code word that for communism, okay? Feminism has nothing to do with women. It has to do with making the state paramount over everybody. It has to do with subjugating the most incredibly wonderful human relationship, marriage, to the state's power. Okay, that's what feminism is all about. It wants to tear down the family and bring the state into private life. So I'm going to give American men a pass. They have been feminized and demasculinized, and all masculinity has been robbed in the pursuit of the state as all-powerful father and husband, okay? But still, guys, I mean, get a backbone. Lay down the law and tell your wife, you're not going to the airport. You are not flying, because I won't put up with it. I've told my husband that. My husband loves to travel, and I said to him, I won't tolerate. I will not tolerate a goon putting his hands where I put my hands. No. Nobody has been touched. You are precious to me, and I won't allow it. If I can do this as a woman, where are the men saying that to their wives? Why isn't there more outrage? Why aren't parents telling your children, no, we're not going to Disney World, and here's why? Because I love you too much to see a thug put his hands down your britches. We're not going to do it.
Yeah, and you use the word lackey there. That's not a word that I hear all that often, but I thought when you said it, I thought, wow, that just nails it. That is exactly what one of these people that would behave this way. That's exactly what they are. And it's not, we shouldn't ever even consider the idea that these people are helping us be safe in any way. You know, I've made the argument over and over that a person who is serious about wanting to harm other people, these silly antics that they pull are not going to stop that person, and the evidence is proof of that.
You're absolutely right on, Ben, and it's even worse than that. The TSA actually endangers flights. They have had, get this, okay, remember that these TSA goons come in with very little training. I'm talking a couple of days, okay? Mm. And the TSA actually thinks these people can inspect aircraft for safety. So the TSA's goons have done things like use very sensitive equipment on the aircraft to pull themselves up into the cabin. And these were gauges that judge how much ice is on the wings. My cousin's a private pilot. I'll tell you right now, his number one fear is ice on the wings. You get ice on an aircraft's wings, it crashes. These bugs, these goons, these incomprehensibly idiotic apes pulled themselves up by those gauges, ruined them. All right. Now, fortunately, the airline, I think it was Delta, caught that before any planes crashed. But the Delta spokesman admitted, we don't know how many other aircraft they've damaged. They caught 9. Could have been more.
Wow.
TSA murdered a passenger. Okay, I don't know if everybody remembers Rigoberto Alcazar. I do my best to mention him whenever I can. This man was a Christian missionary, short-term, flying home from Central or South America. I forget where his flight originated, to Miami. He had to catch a connecting flight from Miami to his home in Florida. He got onto that connecting flight, you know, end of the trip, had a panic attack and went to get off. TSA air marshals, tragically enough, were on that flight. They chased this agitated man down the runway and shot him dead. Okay? So the TSA has killed him. What was the excuse? He said he had a bomb. Strangely enough, only the marshals heard that. None of the passengers did. In fact, the passengers went out of their way to say. The only time we heard the B word was when the FBI mentioned it while interrogating us.
Wow.
Okay? TSA has killed people. Now, here, it gets even scarier, folks. Those marshals were never, ever tried. They were not suspended.
Oh, of course not.
The White House praised the fact, and so did John Mica, a representative from Florida. You'd think he might be concerned about a dead constituent. Nope, not at all. The system worked exactly as designed, is what Mike had to say on it. And the White House praised the marshals' quick actions as well. So understand, when you go and get on a flight, if there are plainclothes TSA air marshals aboard, you run a risk of being murdered in cold blood. Okay, so the TSA not only can't protect us with its sexual assault and its other hijinks, it also kills passengers and ruins aircraft.
That is an amazing story. I think it needs to be repeated as often as possible. That is just appalling. But you know, that's kind of the, well, I don't mean to just single out police, and I don't mean to change the whole topic here, but that's kind of the mentality of all of what we're seeing all over the place with police shooting people just because they're running, even though they're not necessarily, it's like there's been cases where they didn't really even know what the person was running for. And the answer is to shoot him. It's like, you know, it's like a dog that sees something run, and that deep down inside that wolf instinct causes them to attack. And you have to teach a dog not to behave that way. But we have humans doing this.
Yes, we have humans doing this. Interestingly enough, I'm always intrigued at the distinction that Americans have been taught, propagandized, to draw between police and army. And we have the Posse Comitatus Act, and we have, you know, all the other cops do domestic law enforcement, and the armies for overseas. Actually, they were one and the same in the 18th century. You all remember the Boston Massacre. That is precisely what was going on. British Army was policing Boston. They were fulfilling all the functions that cops today do. They were doing things like scouting out lawbreakers in how that was defined then, as now, is people breaking the government's rules so we can fine them for that privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so just as cops go around and write out traffic tickets today, British Army soldiers were going around Boston writing out tickets, so to speak, for people who were evading the customs duties. Okay, and they were apprehending these people. They were also sniffing out any signs of rebellion or revolt against the government, just as cops do today. How many terrorists have been apprehended by various police because the terrorists were involved in some sort of discussion group the government didn't like? Okay, so that's where cops come from, in fact. They, in the 18th century, armies patrolled their own cities. In London, riots regularly rocked London because there was such outrage at the American Revolution. The British taxpayers in London did not want their dollars spent to kill their cousins here, and they would riot. So regiment of the army would be called out. That's where you get riot act. They had to read a warning to the people that if they didn't disperse and go to their homes immediately, that the riot act, that they would begin shooting. So you had to read the riot act first before you could do that. But this is all what happened in the 19th century then, is that a man named Robert Peel, early 19th century, was deputized by the British Crown to figure out a way to quell uprisings in Ireland, because then as now, the Irish didn't care for being made second-class citizens in their own homes. And so they were rebelling against the Crown. And Robert Peel, Member of Parliament, was supposed to come up with a way to prevent that. He came up with the idea of cops, okay? And he spent the rest of his life promoting this. So, again, this distinction between domestic law enforcement and an army is a very artificial one. We owe it all to this MP who achieved a lot of fame and wealth through this, okay? But it is as inimical to liberty, perhaps even more so than an outright army policing us. And one of the reasons I say that is because Peel made this very socially acceptable. He basically said, you know, it's incumbent on every citizen to do what the army does. Every citizen should be turning traitors into the government. I didn't say it that plainly. Okay, I am paraphrasing, but that's the intent of his words. All of us should be turning each other in. All of us should be ratting out our neighbors to the government. So when we have cops, they kind of take the dirtiness off of that. You see, we've been conditioned to think they're our friends and they protect us, okay? And isn't that interesting, Ben, how the state strips us of our weapons so that we can't protect ourselves and then asks us to depend on their lackeys to protect us and turn us in?
Amazing. And you mentioned Ireland. We're coming up on a break, but I'll just throw this out really quickly. The English had disarmed the Irish prior to Peel going over there and setting up his bobbies. So that was actually one of their steps, was to disarm the Irish first, make it against the law for them to carry any kind of weaponry, and then send in these guys to police them.
Yes, just as the Nazis did the German people.
Yeah. When we come back from this break, we'll pick back up on this. Stick with us. Ben Stone and Becky Aker will be right back.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us through the break. I'm back with Becky Akers on Bad Quaker Podcast. And once again, I want to mention that, Becky, really often her work appears over at Lou Rockwell, but you can also find it at Campaign for Liberty, The New American, The Freeman, and a lot of other places on the Internet. Just Google Becky Akers' name or follow some of the links that I'm setting up at Bad Quaker where this podcast appears. And I'll also find some links for Paige Smith. She mentioned him, and along with some of the other things that we're going to be talking about in this podcast. Becky, thanks again for being on the show with me. We got about 15, 20 more minutes here. What would you, it's hard to look at everything that's going on in America right now and say, well, this is just going to keep going. Everything's going to be, sponge cake and butterflies, and we're all going to be happy, and it's going to keep going like this forever. What do you think I'll put this in quotes, the USA, what do you think that's going to look like in about 100 years or so?
Well, I kind of have a cheat sheet because I've got the revolution and what happened then to guide me, and history does repeat, primarily because very few people ever learn from it. And the revolution isn't the only template. We have other countries that have followed this same fascist corporatist track. You can look at Germany. You can look at Russia. We are basically treading the same routes towards totalitarianism, with the government entwined in every segment of our lives, whether personal or private, or personal or public. We have the same kind of corporatist, totalitarian economy. People have to be licensed before taking virtually any job anymore. If you're not licensed for the job itself, you have to be licensed to travel to it in your car. You get a marriage license. Basically, anything you want to do, you get a license to build another room onto your house on your own property. Basically, anything we want to do now, the government gives us permission. That's totalitarianism. It may be soft totalitarianism. We're not to the level yet of people disappearing off the streets as they have done in Central and South American communist dictatorships and overseas. But we're approaching that. National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, has given the feds the power to do exactly that now. So I see us going in one of two directions, and neither of them is very pretty. I see us continuing with the vast majority of Americans as apathetic and contented as they are now, turning a blind eye to all this until it's too late. And by too late, I mean that the government goes door-to-door confiscating all guns. That's coming. I don't know when. I can't tell you how, but it has characterized, that's exactly what the British were doing at Lexington and Concord. They were seizing armaments that the American colonists had stockpiled for use against the government. Okay, our government is stupid, all governments are, but eventually it will figure that out. And let me say, that is the only difference between us and most other victimized peoples. We are still armed. And on the day they come to get your gun, I would fight them to the death, because you're going to wind up in a concentration camp otherwise, okay? So either we're going to just continue down this path of totalitarianism and eventually get to full-blown, these people are disappearing, you don't say one word against the government in private or public, the walls have ears, all of that. The worst stories of Nazi Germany, communist Russia, communist China under Mao, all of that will take place here. Or we will have a revolution, and the abuses the feds are dishing out will become so horrendous. Sexual assault will be not only at the airports, but throughout society from government officials, government lackeys. Children will be kidnapped, taken away, even more than they are now, by Child Protective Services, always for their protection, of course. All of that, people will finally rise up. Now, the real danger of all that, however, is that there is so much ignorance about political philosophy. The Occupy Wall Street movement was really scary. The reason being that these people were right to protest. We have a rotten system. It is satanic. It needs to be done away with. But they had no understanding that what they're protesting against with corporatism means the government as well. All they were doing was protesting what they see as free enterprise. Of course, it wasn't. It's a caricature of that. But they're so ignorant, they don't realize that. And that's what's scary about a shooting revolution, because we are going to come out of it with even worse tyranny than we already have. Now, that was a danger, actually, during the American Revolution as well. There were a group of patriots headquartered in Philadelphia known as radical patriots, as if the real patriots weren't radical enough. What they were was socialists. The word didn't exist, they didn't call themselves that, but they wanted a very strong central government. They went around trying to get anybody who wasn't committed heart and soul to the revolution and didn't show the same fervor that the radical patriots did, tried to get them hanged. Okay? That is something, by the way, that was very rare in the American Revolution. We did not hang loyalists. We may have hounded them and persecuted them, but we didn't hang them, in contrast to the French Revolution, which hanged people wholesale. But at any rate, the radicals went around trying to get a strong central government. They eventually, since Congress met in Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania was an extremely influential state, contributing lots of men and material, the radicals actually took over Congress for a while. They tried to get things like laws against theater. Okay, they wanted to control your private morals, just as they wanted to control your income. They had all kinds of wage and price controls that they tried out in Philadelphia. They basically drove the economy of Philadelphia to the brink of bankruptcy. People were leaving in droves. And then Benedict Arnold came along. Now, he's always presented as a traitor. Benedict Arnold is actually a huge hero. The reason everyone thinks he's a traitor is because the radical patriots basically wrote his biography after the war, okay? Mm-hmm. Arnold stood up to these thugs and these tyrants, and eventually when he did try to sell West Point to the British, he was going back to a king who could protect America from the socialism of the radical patriots. That's why he committed his treason. My second novel on which I'm working is about Benedict Arnold and what a hero he was. I am the only historian who has ever presented this theory. And I'm amazed nobody else came up with this, but this is the value of not depending on academic historians, not depending on secondary sources, going to the original primary sources. These are the kind of insights you glean, okay? Had I gone to graduate school, I graduated undergraduate from Barnard College at Columbia University, and had I gone to Columbia University, I'd be turning out histories like Eric Foner, who is a huge socialist, he's a professor, or was, I think he's dead now, professor at Columbia, just turned out socialist history after socialist history, sees the revolution through a Marxist lens. If he knows anything about the radical patriots, he probably thinks they're great folks. Very difficult to find information on them in secondary sources. Virtually nobody's written about them. I found original sources and one secondary source on them written, incidentally, by an outright Marxist in the 1930s. But once you understand all this, you see where Arnold was going and why he wanted to get America back under the protection of a British king to protect against the even worse radicals. Okay, so I see us going in that direction. We're either going to have an outright revolution like the radicals wanted, where we wind up with far more totalitarianism than when we went into it, or we wind up with a full-fledged concentration camp. Dissidents will be killed, and so will anybody else that it falls, their group falls into disfavor momentarily with the population at large. I look for Islam, Muslims. Muslims will be among the first that are rounded up. After dissidents, you know, dissidents are always the biggest threat, but then it'll be Muslims. If I were black, I'd be getting out of here, because black Americans have always gotten a raw deal, and they will be some of the first rounded up, too. May not be on racial grounds, maybe on made-up, trumped-up excuses, but I would be very, very nervous about living here in this country, were I Muslim or black.
Well, you can see that firsthand, and you mentioned you're in New York City. You can see that firsthand in New York City with the stop and I can't remember the terminology.
Yes,
they use.
Stop and frisk.
Yeah. That are way disproportionately young black males that are being harassed like this.
Yes, the state has made war on the black population for, you know, everybody thinks that war ended with slavery. It didn't. The state has been out to get black people, and my heart goes out to anyone black. I disagree with the predominant socialism that the black community advances. I hope and pray you will wake up, folks, at some point and realize government is not your friend. No matter how much it steals from whitey and gives to you, that's not good. It is going to stab you and kill you in the end. Wake up before it's too late. Understand the price that you're paying for government's patronage of you. I don't see any good results. I see just increasing tyranny, whether we have a shooting revolution or whether the government just begins imprisoning folks.
I've often said, of course, I haven't spent much time in my life in big cities. I've been on the outskirts of L.A. Enough to know that I don't want to ever even be on the outskirts of L.A. again. I've never really
reaction, Ben.
I've never really understood how people can be comfortable in a big city. So I've got you captive here to ask you, explain to me how you can tolerate living in New York City.
Well, I'll give a word of advice to everybody who is considering college either for himself or for his children. I didn't realize that college is like a big black hole and just sucks you in. And basically, whatever geographic region you attend school, you're probably going to wind up settling there. There are two reasons for that. First of all, you meet the most wonderful man in the whole wide world, and you fall passionately in love, and you marry him. And that was my story. Secondly, all your contacts that you make for professional pursuits are going to be through your college, and most of those people probably are going to settle in the same area. So again, you've got that double tie. You're going to wind up settling for where you've gone to school. So don't choose Columbia University in New York City, because that was my big mistake. But it is interesting, now, Ben. I'm from the Midwest originally. My husband and I go out there very frequently because my father was widowed when I was 18, so we are always very concerned about him. So we go home to visit as much as we can. And my husband and I, my husband's a native, we both agree that the tyranny is just as prevalent out there as it is here. It's just a different style. There, it's much more cloaked in the "we just want to help." We're all just one big happy family. You're not raising your children the way we think you should. So we're gonna take them away from you, and they'll be okay. Don't worry. We're gonna raise them for you for a while, so they'll be better when they come back to you. Okay, as opposed to New York, which is get out of my face. What are you doing? I want to call the cops. Now the cops are here. They're gonna teach you how to behave. That's how it is in New York City. But there is no less tyranny. It's the same thing in the end. It is the state superintending every aspect of personal and public life.
Kind of reflecting back on something you said a moment ago, too, I've often said that as this situation turns worse and worse, the people that depend on the government the most are going to be consumed by the government. The government is going to fall on them with particular aggression. And that's the same out in the country. I see it among, you know, what people will derogatorily call the poor white trash or trailer trash or these different phrases like this.
Yeah.
The level of dependency on the government is directly proportioned to the amount the government is going to fall on those people and just destroy them, inner city or in the country. I've made that argument.
You are absolutely correct about that. I am astonished. I did a story one time on a woman who was so poor, she was not only living in a trailer, she was living there with something like four other adults, I think, maybe three or four. She had two children, toddlers, and I thought this was very clever of her. She came up with the idea of buying a very large dog kennel and putting them in it at night because these boys were sleepwalkers and she was afraid they hurt themselves while they were out sleepwalking. So, and, you know, since she works all day to afford the rent on the trailer and their food and everything, she couldn't stay up all night to watch her children. Child Protective Services came in and took those boys away from her, imprisoned her as well as all the other adults living there because none of them stopped this. Now, if that isn't absolute heartbreaking victimization of a poor woman who had probably accepted all kinds of government help, how was she even on their radar was what I wanted to know. Okay, so when you go to the government and you take their food stamps and you take their welfare vouchers, you are setting yourself up. You enroll your children in their public schools. They've now got a record that you have your kids. You go to the hospital and you fill out a birth certificate. They know. I mean, come on, people. We have to hide from these enemies. They are rabid wolves seeking whom they may devour. And they will devour us. And the more that you interact with them, the likelier it is you're going to be one of their first victims. I see the same thing then with corporations. I'm always amazed at the corporations that willingly undertake business with the federal government. Because you know what? You tip off a bureaucrat and boom, those contracts are investigated and all the cozy little deals land you in jail because you crossed a bureaucrat. I've read that time and time again with various corporations that supply TSA, and yet the line to supply the TSA, out the door, around the block, because there's so much money. Don't let your greed blind you to what government is. It is force. It will turn on you. It will annihilate you.
I think that's critical to understand for business owners. It is so tempting to get in and get a hold of these contracts and so forth. But like you were just saying, you know, even if they come in and they inspect your business and the IRS comes in and looks everything over, and let's say they don't find anything, they still consume massive amounts of your money and your time and your effort and your employees' time just justifying your business to these clowns. They can come into a small business like the guitar company. Did you hear about the guitar company? They just consume massive amounts of the company's wealth just trying to justify yourself against these idiots.
Yes, and I think it's really sad that we don't all band together and just blow them out of the water, the bureaucrats, okay? That's one of the huge problems with the American system of government right now is we imported that whole bureaucratic structure from 1870s Germany, from Bismarck. He's the one that came up with this bureaucracy and the idea that experts will control us and experts will oversee every aspect of our lives. We now have a bureaucratic regime that is far more powerful than the obvious government we see. Okay, Congress is nothing. The bureaucracies are the ones ruling this country.
Right.
We need to rise up en masse against these people. TSA, FAA, IRS, the whole bureaucratic regime, the DEA, all of them, Customs, Border Protection, the National Education Department, the whole thing. We need to rise up against these people and get rid of them. They have no constitutional authority to reign over us, and they do. It was a real sleight of hand. They got these people in. Congress did an end run around the Constitution and basically passed the Administrative Procedures Act saying that they would delegate their authority to legislate to bureaucracies, okay? Well, there's nowhere in the Constitution where Congress is allowed to delegate authority, okay? That's first of all. Secondly, the powers that they're delegating to bureaucracies, there is nothing in the Constitution granting Congress authority over those spheres to begin with. Congress has no authority to protect transportation. How can it then delegate that authority to the TSA? It can't do that. This is illegal. So the entire bureaucratic regime is illegal. And the fact that we've got nine clowns in gowns on the Supreme Court agreeing that it's perfectly okay doesn't make it so. It's still anti-constitutional. And if you're literate and you can read the Constitution, you can see how totally illegal, totally unconstitutional the entire bureaucratic regime is.
Becky, I hate to cut this off. This is going so well. I think we could sit here and talk for hours like this.
Yes. I think so, Ben. You got me going, and I don't shut up easily.
Oh, well, yeah, but it's like this is exactly the things that I try to talk about as often as possible, and I try to share with people, you know, family members and so forth, and it's just thrilling to hear somebody else saying these things with the same, the same enthusiasm that I find myself with. I'm really so happy you came on the show today. I'm going to have to cut us off, unfortunately, for time limitations, but I want to say, Becky, you know, I really want to have you back on the show. Anytime you feel like you want to come on the show, or if you have anything specific you want to talk about, drop me a note and we will certainly arrange it. But in the meantime, I really appreciate you coming on the show with me and talk about these things.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's been a real honor and privilege, as I said, and you just keep fighting for liberty.
Thank you very much. And folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com.